This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iran, Israel, and the atom bomb. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Talks on Iran's plan to enrich uranium resume today in Vienna, but nobody expects much progress, especially after Iran's president ridiculed the Holocaust and said Israel should be wiped off the map. Was that a real threat? Was it international posturing, or mainly for domestic consumption? On To The Point, we'll talk about Iran's internal politics and the chances that Israel will make a preemptive strike. How close is Iran to manufacturing a nuclear weapon? On Reporter's Notebook later on, has Iraq's election produced a nation more divided than ever? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point. Iran is continuing to insist on its right to enrich uranium despite international fears about developing nuclear weapons. On To The Point, how close is Iran to building a bomb? Will Israel stage a preemptive strike? Can Germany, France, and Britain make a difference? On Reporter's Notebook, in Iraq, some Sunni Arabs put down their arms for last week's voting. Will the election results produce a return to violence? First, this news update. Vice President Cheney broke a tie in the Senate today, giving Republicans a one-vote margin for spending cuts in Medicaid, Medicare, and student loans. But they failed to get oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, at least the first time around. Jody Schneider is economics editor at Congressional Quarterly. And Jody, thanks for joining us.
Certainly.
Vice President gave the Republicans a 51-50 vote margin, as close as it's possible to get in the Senate. That means there were Republican defectors. What were they worried about?
Well, they had a victory, but it wasn't a total victory. This has to now go back to the House, and the House is gone. The House has left for the year. They could potentially get a voice vote tomorrow, because they're going to have kind of a pro forma session tomorrow, but that isn't likely. They're going to have to. The Democrats are going to require a roll call vote in the House. So this will extend into next year. What happened was the Democrats basically raised a budget point of order is what it's called procedurally, and on a couple provisions that they said violated Senate budget reconciliation rules, and that required them to send it to the House because the legislation then becomes amended and you can't amend conference reports. So they won by just the narrowest of margins. As you pointed out, they had to call in Dick Cheney, but they didn't really totally win. This is not clear. This does not go to the president's desk.
And this is because some Republicans in that Senate with a 55-vote margin refused to vote for this bill. What were their concerns?
Right. The moderate Republicans who opposed it were Gordon Smith of Oregon, who has long opposed any cuts to the health care programs. We call them the ladies from Maine, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, who have opposed several things in there, including the health care cuts, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, who often votes with the Democrats, and Mike DeWine of Ohio. So it was kind of a variety of things, but what's interesting is they lost a few Republicans, and the Democrats stood firm, as they did on the next bill that I'm sure we're going to talk about, the Defense Appropriations Bill. The Democrats have been able, on some of these major budget and appropriations issues this year, to stand firm.
Of course, we want to talk about the Defense Appropriations Bill, and it has something tacked onto it, which is very important, and that is drilling in Anwar. The Democrats managed to hold that back.
Right, right. They did. What ended up happening today in the Defense Appropriations Bill, which now has a lot of other things on it, including, most importantly, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Anwar, as we call it, the vote was 56-44 to invoke cloture, or therefore limit debate. On the conference report, it fell short of the 60 votes needed to shut off filibuster. You needed 60 votes rather than just a simple majority. So basically, at that point, they don't go to the underlying bill. You don't get a vote on the Defense Appropriations Bill with Anwar. And essentially, Anwar looks pretty dead now. The one thing that could happen is the House taking it up, but the House has left town. again, you know, in that kind of situation, they went ahead and they adopted both these bills, the budget reconciliation bill and the defense appropriations bill, in the early hours Monday morning, and then they left town.
Does this mean then that the defense appropriations bill won't be passed this year?
No, that's highly unlikely, and everybody and the Democrats made big speeches before the vote to ensure everybody that we're going to provide money for the troops. What will likely happen is they will do something called, they'll win consent for something called an enrolling resolution, which removes ANWR language from the conference report. Then that the Senate today, before they leave, would go ahead and they would pass that. It would go to the House, and the House, which is going to have its little pro forma session tomorrow, mm-hmm. would then likely, on a voice vote, approve that.
So it's all about the rules at this point.
Right.
We're talking Jody Schneider, economics editor at Congressional Quarterly. There's also the Patriot Act. The president, once again, coming out today saying that that America needs it in order to keep safe, and yet he and the Republicans refuse a three-month extension, or at least they have so far. Any chance of reconciling that?
No, that looks fairly dead for the year here. As of today, and of course they've been busy with other things today, but as of today, neither side looked like they were budging on that. And the Republican leaders assert that because the House is left for the year, the only alternative is to accept the conference report or let the law expire. And it looks like that will happen, that the law will expire. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't come back when they come back in January and pass a one-year extension, that kind of thing. But technically, the law will very likely expire.
So what we've seen then in the past few hours is, as you pointed out, the Democrats holding together, the Republicans not.
Right, and Bill Frist not seeming to be able to, to do much to keep his caucus in order. Ted Stevens, you know, was sort of ruling the roost there. Now, Ted Stevens could continue to try to fight this and pull some other procedural maneuver out of his hat to try to, you know, make things even more complicated and not allow them to take ANWR out. But one would think at this point that Bill Frist is just going to say, look, it's more important to have the defense appropriations bill than for you to continue to be able to, to keep on with
all right,
the
Bill
ANWR
Frist,
debate.
The Republican leader in the Senate, and Ted Stevens, the senator from Alaska, wants that ANWR drilling. Jody Schneider, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Economics editor at Congressional Quarterly. In a moment, Iran, Israel, and the atom bomb on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Iran met with Germany, France, and Britain today in Vienna on the issue of Iran's intention to enrich uranium. It's the first such meeting since August, and the parties agreed to meet again next month. In the meantime, the Western world has been furious with Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, for saying that the Holocaust never happened and that Israel should be wiped off the map. Angus McDowell is Tehran correspondent for London's Independent newspaper. Angus, good to have you back with us.
Hello, Warren.
Why did the president at this time make these very provocative statements about Israel?
Well, I think that's really the key question, and it's something that's being debated very much inside Iran. There are a number of different possibilities. I mean, some people say that, well, he's an inexperienced president, and he didn't necessarily mean to cause quite the international uproar that he did. He was perhaps just spouting off without really considering the effect of his words. Other people believe that this is perhaps a more deliberate policy to perhaps create a more isolationist feel in Iran that would bring other members of the regime around to his point of view and perhaps also distract attention from domestic issues, where he's having trouble carrying out the economic promises that he made at his the time of his election.
How does that work? How is it that mentioning Israel in this way and creating a controversy about it would help to create unity in his own party?
Well, I think that the problem that he's facing is that for the first few months of his presidency, a lot of people were looking far more to what other figures in the regime were saying, and they were concentrating also on his own inability to carry out domestic policy issues, things like he was unable to appoint an oil minister. The parliament in Iran, which comes from his own faction, was actually turning down choice after choice that he had made of oil minister in an attempt then to distract these people from local issues and to focus on something that was outside of Iranian domestic politics, the things that he thinks perhaps really matter to people inside the country. He was he was creating an external crisis that would force other members of the regime actually to gather around him in a show of unity.
Then what about the very tough line that Iran has taken on uranium enrichment? We heard it again today in Vienna. They insisted that under no circumstances will Iran give up its opportunity, its right, as it says, to enrich uranium on its own soil. They've turned down the idea of having the enrichment occur on Russian soil. Why are they taking such a tough stand there?
Well, again, I mean, this is a president who is very ultra-nationalist in his viewpoint, and he's pushing things. There's a school of thought that says that it's only really when Iran pushes, when it comes out aggressively, that it can actually force concessions from the international community. So far, from conversations that I've had with diplomats and other people in Tehran, I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. Also, I think it's true to say that a lot of other people inside Tehran, a lot of people from within the regime, are getting quite worried about the hardline stance that this president is taking. And for all of his attempts to create a show of unity domestically, that's something that he hasn't yet been able to achieve. The really big questions at the moment in Iran are how far he has the support of other senior figures in the regime, like the supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, like his defeated presidential opponent Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who is head of a very powerful body that was given extra powers in October by the supreme leader. And so far it's unclear whether he actually enjoys the support of these other groups or whether he's striking out on his own to try to push Iranian policy in a more extreme direction.
Angus McDowell, again, Tehran correspondent for London's independent newspaper, talking today about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the new president of Iran. Dr. Saeed Rajai Khorasani is former Iranian permanent representative to the United Nations, held that position during the 1980s, founder of Human Rights Committee in the Iranian parliament, and now professor of philosophy at Iran's Assad University. Thank you, professor, very much for joining us today. Do you agree with what we heard from Angus McDowell, that the president is in a weak position in his own country, and that some of the things that we're focused on in the West are really more on his part aimed at his own local constituency than they are at the international community?
Partially, I fully agree with him. And I believe he's really into the trend of he's not a minded man. And I think what he was simply out of ignorance. That's what to take is.
Mr. Ambassador, excuse me for a moment, if you will. We're having a hard time hearing you on the international cell phone. I wonder if you could back off a bit from your speaker and start again, if you will. Okay, we're having no luck, I'm afraid, with Dr. Khorasani. We will try to get him back. We want very much to have an Iranian point of view on our program. First, I want to go to Valerie Lindsay, who's editor and principal researcher for IranWatch.org. That's a website published by the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington. She herself is in Paris today. And Ms. Lindsay, thank you very much for joining us from there.
My pleasure.
What can you tell us about the International Atomic Energy Agency? And the Nobel Prize winner, of course, Mr. Albaradei, has been very critical of Iran in the area of uranium enrichment. How certain is he and is the international agency that what Iran really wants is to develop nuclear weapons?
Well, he's, at least on the record, not certain at all. He has repeatedly said that there is no smoking gun. There is no definitive proof that what Iran is doing is seeking nuclear weapons. And indeed, the inspectors, the IAEA inspectors who have been in Iran since 2003, have not found such proof. So what we have are a series of indicators that suggest that at the very least, what Iran is seeking is a nuclear weapon capability, the ability on short notice to manufacture nuclear weapons.
On short notice. So what does that mean? How much time does the rest of the world have in that context?
Well, at this point, we have some time, which is why the negotiations, as they've been ongoing, are a positive thing, because while they continue, Iran has continued the freeze of its uranium enrichment program, which is sort of the program of concern for nuclear weapons. And there's the hope that if those negotiations continue, we can sort of put off to the future a time at which Iran would have that capacity. At this point, we're sort of early in the game yet.
What do you think, and what does your organization, IranWatch.org, believe about Iran's intentions?
Well, we believe that if you look at a couple of factors, first, the type of nuclear technology that Iran has sought, and the experiments that it's undertaken. It's sought to procure centrifuges to enrich uranium. It has conducted its experiments to produce plutonium and enriched uranium, which are the two materials that can be used in nuclear weapons. Second, if you look at the way in which Iran has done these things, which is to say secretly, they procured material and technology on the black market through the network run by the Pakistani scientist AQ Khan. They conducted a number of experiments in secret, never declaring them to the IAEA as they were required to do. And this went on for nearly two decades. The third thing that's suspicious to us is the timing, which is Iran began meeting with intermediaries of the Khan network in the mid to late 80s, in the early 90s. This corresponds with the Iran-Iraq War. It corresponds in the early 90s with the discovery by the UN of Saddam Hussein's quite advanced nuclear weapon program. And so at that time, Iran had a number of serious national security concerns and was probably not focused too much on developing a new and complicated source of or a way of generating electricity. So for those three reasons, I think, principally, we believe that Iran, at the very least, wants to develop a nuclear weapon capability, if not a nuclear weapon itself at this point.
Valerie Renzi again with IranWatch.org. Listening very carefully to what we have just heard, still on the line from Tehran is Dr. Saeed Rajaei Khorasani, again, the former UN representative, a member of the Iranian parliament. Let me ask you, if I may, and I hope our phone connection will work this time, to respond to what we just heard.
To.
Go ahead, if you will, sir, and respond that this is these are strategies, techniques that are useful in weapons, that it's been done secretly, and the timing has coincided with other important international events.
Why don't you go to Mr. Albaradei, who is the referee in all these issues? I mean, the International Atomic Agency is the impartial body who should pass judgment on everything that these different people are commenting. Therefore, don't rely on these things. Rely on what Mr. Albaradei says. He's the right man.
Well, he has said, as Valerie Lindsay indicated, that there's no definitive proof or evidence at this point. Nonetheless, he's also expressed a great deal of concern, particularly about the secrecy.
But concern is something emotional. Facts of the situation are with Mr. Albaradei. Now, if you want to get rid of your emotional problems, simply go to Mr. Albaradei. He gives you the right answer.
We did ask
Don't go to different commentators who wish just to produce a program for their own purposes. I don't know what they are.
We did ask for a spokesperson from the IAEA today, and we're told that that person who normally does perform that task and has been on our program is not available. Let me go back to Valerie Lindsay. Can you tell us, from your point of view, what it is that you think Mr. Al-Baradei has said, in addition to indicating, as you said before, that there's no definitive proof and no evidence?
Well, in terms of the IAEA passing judgment, it's the Board of Governors of the IAEA that passes judgment. Al-Baradei and the inspectors, the agency itself, has been busy for a couple of years now gathering evidence. And the number of the things that I pointed out are facts that have emerged thanks to that investigation. In September, the IAEA Board of Governors did pass judgment on Iran in the sense that they voted a resolution that found Iran in noncompliance with its NPT obligations and said that these violations merited being examined by the UN Security Council. Now, that the nuclear dossier has not gone to the Security Council. That still has to be voted. But in terms of passing judgment, that has been done. Iran has been found in noncompliance.
The NPT, of course, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Back to Dr. Khorasani. What about that?
I did not listen what she said.
What she said was that the Board of Governors, not Mr. Al-Baradei, has the authority to make judgments in this issue.
Well, and they have every authority. I'm not speaking about the authority they have. I say the facts of the situation are with Mr. Al-Baradei. In order to learn about the facts of the situation, why don't you go to him? I don't say go to him right now. Tomorrow, yesterday, the day before, 2 days afterwards, you can consult him, you can consult his office and get his viewpoints instead of just commenting, different people commenting on issues that, on the basis of rumors.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. What about the Board of Governors finding Iraq to have been in noncompliance with the Nonproliferation Treaty?
Come on. Look, if you want me to listen, then you have to listen to me. You have to go to the right authority. The right authority is the International Atomic Agency, Mr. Al-Baradei. That's it. Don't waste your time.
All right. Dr. Khorasani, I think, is having a difficult time hearing you, Valerie Lindsay, and we'll indicate that we understand that. Let me go back to Angus McDowell, who's still with us, and also in Tehran for London's Independent newspaper. What do you make of what we're hearing here as far as it reflects upon Iranian thinking about this issue?
Well, I mean, from my perspective here, I mean, when I talk to Iranians, when I ask them what they think about the whole issue, most people that I talk to are very supportive of Iran's nuclear program insofar as they see it. The nuclear power program, the peaceful program, and the fuel cycle that goes along with that, they see that as an inalienable Iranian right, and they see it as something more than that. They see it as almost an emblem of the club of modernity. This has been an ambition of Iran since well before the revolution, and it's something that has often been talked of as...
All right. We're going to have to take a very brief break. We'll come back. Please, all of our guests, do stay with us, if you will, including you, Dr. Khorasani. We'll be right back with To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point. Once again, talking about Iran and its nuclear program, having some difficulty on the line from Tehran with Dr. Khorasani, but we'll try to get back to him if we can. In the meantime, Angus McDowell is there, correspondent for London's Independent newspaper. And Angus, you were saying that you find that Iranians in general are very supportive of the nuclear power program, in part for nationalistic reasons. How do they feel, do you think, if it's possible to sample public opinion, about this issue of nuclear weapons?
Well, again, I mean, this is something that you talk to people about, and I don't think that there's... It's an issue where you can't really ascribe opinions to Iranians according to their factional support of different different political groups. I mean, across the spectrum from conservative to reformist, you will find some people who completely, bitterly oppose the idea of having a nuclear weapon whatsoever. And then you will find other people who say, well, look, we're living in a region where Pakistan has the bomb, where Israel has the bomb. We're living in a region which is continually beset by violence. And a strategic nuclear weapon would be a very useful thing to have. It would act as a deterrent to possible possible attack, perhaps by the United States, perhaps by Israel. And obviously, over the past few months, we've heard reports about American spy drones flying over Iran. We've heard reports about American commando teams infiltrating into Iran. So these are issues which are close to people's minds. And particularly when they look at Pakistan, which is a country where there has been in the past a fair amount of extremist Sunni violence against minority Shias, and Iran, of course, is a Shia country, they get quite worried, and they think that some people think that it would be very useful to have a bomb as a deterrent.
Again, Angus McDowell is in London for The Independent. Want to go make one more try with Dr. Saeed Rajai Khorasani. And, Doctor, what we heard from Angus McDowell is this. He says that all Iranians are very supportive of the nuclear power program, but he feels they are divided when it comes to nuclear weapons, but that some feel that Iran ought to have a nuclear weapon for strategic reasons, that it's in a violent part of the world. What do you think?
No, it's simply wrong. It's completely wrong. Iran doesn't need nuclear weapon. Look, east of us is Iraq. Now we have excellent relations with them. We have Saudi Arabia. We have Kuwait. In the southern borders, we have Arab states, all friendly to us. On the eastern border, we have Pakistan, best relations with them. Afghanistan, we have extremely good relations with them. With northern countries, we have extremely good relations. We are not going to attack China or to be attacked by China. I mean, that's rubbish. Why have you concentrated on something? Probably you need some sort of amusement for your audience. That's a different matter. But you are diluting lots of facts without any good reasons. I think we are not, and we cannot, and we don't want to produce nuclear weapons. We have a good number of nuclear generators for the production of the electricity that we need very badly. And whatever nuclear research we are doing is for the purpose of providing fuel for those generators. That is all. Whether you accept it or not, that is your own business.
Why is it that Iran insists, then, on enriching uranium? Why did it deal secretly with the AQ Khan network?
It's not secret. No, look, it is secret. If you don't know it, it doesn't mean it is secrecy. It is Mr. Al-Baradei who must comment on that. I told you before. It's not a man in the street. We don't need to publicize everything to everybody. The authority, the recognized authority, is Mr. Al-Baradei, International Atomic Agency. Whatever he says and whatever his investigation teams in Iran say, it's acceptable to us. Very simple.
Dr. Saeed Rajai Khorasani, once again, former Iranian representative to the United Nations. Valerie Lindsay, quickly with IranWatch.org. What do you say to this? Mr. Al-Baradei, no evidence produced, and Dr. Khorasani is saying that Iran has no such intention. They only want the fuel for their generators.
Well, first of all, you have to think that Iran right now has one nuclear power plant under construction with Russian assistance that's expected to come online next year. So at this point, it has actually no nuclear power plants running. What it wants to do is run a plant that would produce fuel for this the Bushehr nuclear power reactor. In fact, Iran has a contract with Russia to receive fuel for 10 years following the startup of the reactor. So, naturally, we see a disconnect between wanting to run a peaceful nuclear energy program, which would be fine, and wanting to produce fuel for it, which, due to the dual-use nature of the technology, is quite dangerous for weapon reasons.
Valerie Lindsay with IranWatch.org. There are, of course, many people in the United States very suspicious about Iran's motivations and intentions, and one of them is Ruel Marc Gerecht. He's a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard and the Atlantic Monthly, and former CIA officer in the Middle East. Ruel Marc Gerecht, welcome to you.
A pleasure.
We've been having a debate here about the intentions of Iran, as you can hear, and what exactly the international situation is. You have advocated or have thought, have indicated that you think that it may well be that military action is required. Why do you say that?
Well, because I think it's quite unlikely the clerical regime is going to relent. I think regardless, I mean, it's very difficult to ascertain amongst the Iranian people what are their view, but it does seem fairly clear, and going back to, say, 1989 and 1990, that amongst the clerical elite, the ruling elite, this is actually one of those things which is a common denominator. They seem to be in favor of the program. I would describe it as Rafsanjani's sort of baby, and he and others have rammed it forward, I think, quite diligently and with considerable success, and I would be very astonished to see them relent, even if the Europeans, which they are unlikely to do, mount a serious sanctions approach towards the clerical regime.
Assuming for the moment that there is some intention of building a bomb, what about the argument that Iran is in a very dangerous part of the world, that there are neighbors that have nuclear weapons, Pakistan, and of course Israel, and that for strategic reasons it would be a deterrent to Israel, perhaps to the United States, to invade Iran if it had such a weapon?
Well, I think one of the reasons the Middle East is a somewhat dangerous part of the world is because the clerical regime is very dangerous. I think if you compare and contrast, it certainly is at the top of that scorecard, not at the bottom. So the issue is do you want to have the clerical regime, which has a fairly bad track record with terrorism and other nefarious behavior, do you want these individuals to have a nuclear weapon or not? Now, I think if you have to bet here, the odds are that the United States and the Europeans are going to punt this issue, and the clerics will get their nuke.
And what do you think the consequences of that will be?
Well, I think it would be very bad. I mean, one, I simply don't trust them. There is a revolutionary ideology that's still alive in certain quarters of the clergy, and it is virulently anti-American. It's virulently anti-Israeli. It's virulently anti-Western. And I simply would not, I prefer not to deal with the possibility that they would have the nuke. I think it would vivify the regime. I think it would encourage them to engage in further nasty behavior. Whether they would ever choose to actually play blackmail with a nuclear weapon, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I would be doubtful that they would lend it to terrorist purposes, but at the same time, I simply would prefer not to be in that position.
Ruel Marc Gerecht at the American Enterprise Institute. There have been reports that Israel is prepared to launch a preemptive strike if it feels necessary. The month of March has been suggested as a time when that might be appropriate. Zev Schiff is defense editor for Haaretz, a daily newspaper in Israel, has a liberal outlook. He's also co-author of a book called Lessons from the Middle East. Welcome to our program.
Good day.
What are the prospects in Israel of there being a preemptive strike of some kind?
You see, I doubt it. One has to remember that Israel is a small country. We have a good army, an excellent air force, but still we have to think about the consequence. And the danger, severe danger, if Iran will be equipped with nuclear weapons. But I would say when one speaks about the military option, then it means actually to solve the problem by military means. Israel can, I would say, delay the Iranian project, the nuclear project. Israel can punish Iran, but I doubt if Israel can by itself to solve it by a military option.
Another indication or another problem here with international telephones. which we'll try to clear up in just a moment. Let me go back to Ruelmark Gerecht. Azev Schiff, I think, is saying that, as we heard at the outset, Israel is a small country. It doesn't really want to get into this kind of exchange with its neighbors, but that even if it wanted to, the best it could do is delay the Iranian nuclear program, presuming that there is such a program, trying to build a bomb, for various strategic reasons. Will you explain those? I know you're up to speed on what the difficulty would be for Israel in attacking a country as far away as Iran.
Well, I mean, first and foremost is distance. It's a lot farther to go to Iran than it was to go to Iraq, which the Israelis had done before with the Oseiroc reactor. The Iranian Air Force is a more formidable thing. The air defenses are more formidable. The Iranians learn from the Iraqi experience, and their key facilities that we are aware of are fortified. So,
let me just interrupt. The Iraqi experience in 1981, when Israel attacked its reactor for the same kind of reasons we're talking about today, and took it out, disabled it for a long period. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a much more difficult proposition for Israel, and given the flight paths and flight patterns, refueling, it would be very challenging. That's not to say that the Israelis might not attempt to try it, but it certainly would not be easy. And I suspect they would, in all circumstances, prefer not to go there.
Let me try to go back to Zev Schiff with Haaretz. There's an election coming up. The prime minister is on very shaky ground in Israel. He has indicated that forces are ready for such a strike. What do you think would be the reaction in Israel if, in fact, he launched one?
You see, the reaction will be favorable, but we have to remember that Iran going nuclear, it is not just Iran going nuclear. It means we should see a different... The cell phone is calling, and I shall try to answer on my cell phone.
Okay. Hopefully we will be able to get Mr. Schiff on our cell phone. I don't know why today we are having so much trouble with telephones, but because normally we don't. But this is a bad day. The gremlins are at work as far as our program is concerned. So let me go back to Ruelmark Gerecht. What about the argument that if Israel has atomic weapons, then other countries in the Middle East are going to get them, whether we like it or not?
Well, I don't think that's probably true. I mean, the Iranian program isn't predicated, I think, on the Israelis. And I would add, I mean, Israel is a democracy. If the Iranians were to actually have a democratic regime, I think you would not see as much concern, serious concern, on the part of the Americans and the Europeans. The real truth is the counterproliferation regime more or less ends at the moment that a country goes democratic and it chooses to have a nuclear weapon. I don't think anyone's going to get terribly excised about it. It is the undemocratic nature of the clerical regime. It is its track record with terrorism and other nefarious activities that is so worrisome. So I think the Israeli thing is a dodge that is often used.
I want to go back one more time to Dr. Saeed Rajaei Khorasani in Iran. I don't think he's able to hear our other guests very well, but let me ask you, sir, are you concerned about a possible attack by either Israel or the United States? We have lost that one, obviously. Not able to make the connections that we normally do on our program. Let me just emphasize that this is an unusual moment for us, an experience that we don't have very often. I want to apologize to our listeners for it and try to reassure you that we won't allow it to happen again. We want to get a lot of points of view on this program, and we try very hard to do that. We've tried to do it today. So, Ruelmark Gerecht, finally, back to you. You remain with us and easy to understand. And that is a good thing, although, as I indicated, we like to get to points of view that are contrary to yours as well. You said you think that Iran will get the weapon. How does this compare to the situation with North Korea?
Well, I mean, we're at an earlier stage. I mean, the fear on the Iranian side would be that, in fact, we would get to a North Korean stage. That is, they would have the weapon. And as a earlier guest remarked, the nature of them having that weapon in the Middle East could have a tripwire effect. Obviously, there are others in the regions, both Turks, Egyptians, Saudis. Remember, the Saudis were, it appears, fairly instrumental financially in the development of the Pakistani nuclear program, who would be upset by the Iranians having the nuclear weapon. That's in addition to just the fact that such a nefarious regime having nuclear weapons in and of itself is not a good thing. So it could certainly cause a local arms race, one that I don't think anybody would like to see.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this part of our program. Ruel Mark Garek, thank you for being with us and for being, as you put it, accessible. We're delighted to be able to talk with you. Again, contributing editor at the Weekly Standard, to the Atlantic Monthly, a former CIA officer in the Middle East. And thanks to our other guests. We did hear from Valerie Lindsay of IranWatch.org and Angus McDowell of London's Independent. Thanks also for their efforts to contribute to Zev Schiff of Haaretz in Israel and to Dr. Saeed Rajai Khorasani, Member of Parliament in Iran. With almost 90% of Iraqi votes now counted, Sunni leaders are among those claiming that last week's election must have been rigged. Sunni support will be crucial for any new government to succeed. If they reject it as illegitimate, the result could be civil war. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Popoter's Notebook on To the Point. Sunni Arabs boycotted Iraq's January election, and they were marginalized in the interim government as a result. Last week, they turned out in force, but it's beginning to look as if they may end up with the same result. Wayne White spent 30 years in the State Department, where he focused on intelligence in the Middle East. He's now adjunct scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Mr. White, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How worried are you based on the results so far? What have we learned from them?
I'm very concerned. And in fact, the key word is results. And Sunnis didn't go to the polls, Sunni Arabs, because they love democracy and you know they were enthusiastic about democratic experiments. They went there for results in order to get what they believe is a fair deal in government and a lot of appointments and most importantly some revisions to the Constitution that were thrown as a sort of a bone to them before the last referendum in an attempt to get them to vote for it, which they did not. So, you know, the process is to some degree almost a non-starter for them, because no matter what happens, whether there was fraud there or not, and there was, of course, and it's just a question of how much, they make up no more than maybe 20% of the population. So they're going to be a minority. And particularly if the Shia, who represent maybe 55 or 60% of the country, continue cooperating with the Kurds, representing another 20%, they will remain marginalized. And so getting results for them is going to be really difficult. Therefore, you're going to have frustration, anger, et cetera.
How is it that their expectations were such that they thought that even with just 20% of the population, they would be able to win a decisive voice in the government?
Well, I think two things are at work here. First of all, you have all kinds of arguments in Iraq over what are the population numbers. There are actually Sunni Arabs who claim that actually their real numbers are somewhere between 25 and 40%. Nobody goes along with those figures in sort of academia, among think tankers, experts, et cetera. But it's unimportant what we think. It's what their perceptions are. And the other thing that really hurt them was that Iyad Alawi, who is a moderate Shia, a centrist, secular, and a former member of the Ba'ath Party, but, I mean, one who turned against Saddam many, many years ago, a quarter of a century ago, who many hoped would pull a lot of seats and sort of form a secular center in Iraq, that in a system that very, very badly needs this leaky and shaky ship of state, where he needs, very badly needs a keel, a nice solid keel. He did very poorly. Had he done well, they could have perhaps matched up with him, you know, maybe 40, 45, 50 Sunni Arab seats, plus maybe 50 in Alawi's hands, and suddenly you've got a voting block of over 100 seats, but Alawi is doing very poorly, unexpectedly poorly.
Looking like he's going to get about 20 seats out of 275, so he's not going to be very strong.
Yeah, that's half of what he got the last time. What I suspect happened is not so much that Alawi did poorly, although he did, let's face it, he didn't do measure up to expectations, but some of the seats he lost probably are the ones the Sunnis gained, and so, you know, you haven't gained anything really.
Well, does this suggest that a majority of Iraqis really want to see a Shiite government that has a very religious tinge to it?
Well, that's the problem is that the majority of Iraqis are Shia. So right off the bat, they have a tremendous advantage. And as you're indicating, a sizable part of that population is voting with religious parties. Religious parties, Iranian-backed exile parties, two in particular, one who is which is the party of the current prime minister. Many are following the lead of Grand Ayatollah Sistani. But even on the Sunni Arab side, it'll be interesting to see what kind of seats have been won when we sort out the parties, because many of the Sunni Arab voting voters are also Sunni Arab Islamists. And they tend to gravitate toward the extreme of the political spectrum. And so even within the Sunni community, you could very seriously have walkouts and you know, from the parliament of people who even won seats, you know, over the over what they call our election fraud and what have you.
Talking with Wayne White, who spent 30 years with the State Department focusing on Middle East intelligence, now adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. So I assume then, you seem to be making the assumption that the conservative Shiites, together with the Kurds, who it looks like will have the majority, aren't in and of themselves going to be willing to make the revisions to the constitutions to provide the kind of appointments the Sunnis want to see, or to extend a sort of olive branch.
Yeah, and there are two critical reasons why the Shia and the Kurds are going to hang together: oil and autonomy. The Kurds and the Shia share the desire to control the oil underneath of them. They control the vast majority of all the oil assets in the country. And also, they want significant autonomy, weakening of Baghdad's ability to interfere in government affairs in their provinces. This is exactly what the Sunni Arabs don't want. They don't have the oil, so they want it controlled by the central government. And the only way they can exercise any power is through a substantially empowered central government. And so you can just see we're setting up for a zero-sum game on some of the key issues.
What does that mean, then, in terms of the insurgency? Some of the Sunnis, the Sunni leaders indicated that they wanted people to put down their arms, take a chance on the vote to see what they could get out of the election. Where does this leave them?
Well, it puts us in a very, very difficult spot. It means the insurgency will continue. One thing we have to keep in mind is a lot of Sunni Arab politicians, if they don't toe the line in being hard-nosed about all of this, are in danger of assassination by insurgents. And so their lives are on the line. They cannot make certain compromises or just, you know, throw up their hands and say, so what, I guess I'll just sit in parliament. A lot of them will have to be defiant and tough in all of this. The other problem that you have with the, you know, with respect to the insurgency itself is, of course, conspiracy theories are going to run wild, you know, that Sunnis should have had 10, 20, 30 more seats, and they were cheated out of them. There's going to be a lot of controversy about this, and these rumors will just feed the insurgency in a lot of areas, you know, of the that are dominated by Sunni Arabs, and so it will be robust.
You mentioned Iyad Alawi. He is one of those, again, did very poorly, much more less well than had been anticipated. He's one of those who's saying that the election was rigged. There's even been a call for restaging the vote. What are the prospects for that?
Nil. In fact, the election commissioner, a member of the Dalemi tribe, and I don't know whether he's Shia or Sunni, the Dalemi tribal confederation is huge in Iraq. There are several million members, and some are Sunni, some are Shia. It just shows how even tribes can cross sectarian lines, has refused that. he has said there's no need for a vote, a revote in Baghdad, where it was specifically demanded. We don't know what he's looking at. It may be that he is seeing bits of fraud here and there that don't affect the outcome of the vote. I've heard some anecdotal stories, people coming into the voting booths literally angrily, militiamen with clearly stained fingers demanding to vote again and you know, armed and walking in and, you know, 30 of them voting again and what have you. But that's not enough to change, a seat that's based on tens of thousands of votes.
Just a few seconds left, but what about the prospects for bringing home the troops?
I have a feeling, over time, given the circumstances in the country and American patients, that they're going to come home anyway, but they're going to leave behind a situation that's far from ideal. We are not going to be able to knit together these ethno-sectarian gaps.
So we'll leave chaos behind?
I don't know about chaos, but it won't be pretty, that's for sure.
Wayne White, again, veteran of the State Department, focusing on Middle East intelligence, now adjunct scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, too. Take care.
Today's program produced by Jonah King with Francis Anderton and Katie Cooper, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.